This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Less than a year and a half from now, most of the major elements of the Obama administration's Affordable Health Care Act go into effect. At least those elements that have been found constitutional by the Supreme Court. So just what are those elements? How will they be implemented? And are there likely to be differences here in Virginia compared to other parts of the country? We have two analysts on hand to help address these questions. One has researched healthcare systems and healthcare law across the U.S. and around the world. The other studies politics and public policy across the U.S. and in Virginia in particular. So whatever your concerns about what happens next in healthcare, chances are good legal scholar Tim Jost and political scholar Bob Roberts will have insight to offer. And you're invited to address your specific questions to them right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Got questions about what happens next in healthcare, especially in Virginia? Got opinions on what you think should happen? Health law specialist Timothy Jost is one of our guests. Politics and public policy specialist Bob Roberts is the other. And you are invited to talk with them by dialing in right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Tim Jost from Washington and Lee University. You've studied the Affordable Care Act, as it's officially known, as well as the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling on it, probably as closely as anybody. You've become something of the go-to guy for major news organizations across the U.S. and, in fact, in several other countries. So my basic question to you, Tim, is what is it that people now need to know about the state of healthcare reform that you think they may not know?
Well, I think that one thing we learned last week is that the statute is constitutional. There was a lot of debate about that, and in particular, there was debate about the minimum coverage requirement, the individual responsibility requirement, the individual mandate. It's called different things. The provision that requires that everyone who can afford health insurance, and I think that's a very important point. It only applies to people who can afford health insurance, and we can talk more about that. But it says that if you can afford health insurance, you should have health insurance. And that provision was upheld. The way in which the court did it was a little surprising. It upheld it as an exercise of the power to tax and spend rather than of the commerce power, but the court did uphold it. The court did hold, on the other hand, that the Medicaid expansion, which will cover all Americans up to 138% of the poverty level, is constitutional only as an option, that if states don't want to participate in it, they don't have to. But the court did uphold it as an option, and I would expect that most states, once politics quiets down a little bit and the states take a long, hard look at how much money they're going to lose if they don't participate, how many of their citizens will remain uninsured if they don't participate, I think most states will get on board. So I think we're just moving ahead now. All systems go for implementing the Affordable Care Act.
Bob Roberts from James Madison University, how is the recent Supreme Court decision on health care reform going to play out in Virginia?
That remains to be seen. There is strong opposition among Republicans to all aspects of the bill. And it's become somewhat of an issue that they've been running on, particularly the Attorney General, who will be running for governor next year. However, if we look down the road when this comes up to the legislature next year, and they'll have to act on it next year, decide whether to go opt in or opt out.
Of the Medicaid expansion,
they face a terrible dilemma. If they opt out, they're going to be costing health care providers in the state hundreds of millions of dollars of money they're not getting now to treat unreimbursed care. In other words, this is money they aren't collecting now that they will collect if they opt in. The federal government is going to pay 100% of your costs for the first couple of years, and through 2020, it only drops to 90%. So for a mere 10%, you're going to be getting an unbelievable amount of money. You're going to be propping up your hospitals. You're going to be propping up your doctors. And it's inconceivable that the state wouldn't do it. However, politics would indicate there may be a significant number of legislators who feel as a matter of principle that if they endorse this, they're endorsing the whole bill.
Well, so, this is the General Assembly that put on the record that you could not force Virginians to purchase insurance.
Correct.
And it was based on that law that the state attorney general you mentioned, Ken Cuccinelli, challenged the Federal Health Care Reform Act.
Correct. And now
so the idea that they're going to go forward with what the Obama administration wants them to do as far as Medicaid might seem like a stretch.
Not necessarily. When you think of how Virginia politics work, the sources of campaign contributions, money, comes from, in Virginia, corporations. We have no campaign finance limitations. The ability of the healthcare industry, the managed care industry, the hospitals, to lobby is intense. They're going to be putting a tremendous pressure on these legislators to not do this, to basically to join the system by saying, if you don't join the system, you're going to threaten the hospitals in the state, because you're going to have hospitals in the state who are at a distinct disadvantage and who badly need this money and cannot be assured that the federal government's going to keep reimbursing them for unreimbursed care. And you're really doing nothing for it. I mean, you're not giving, you're giving up a minor amount of money. And in fact, under tax reform proposed by Governor McDonald, which didn't go anywhere, a simple way to cover this, the additional costs, would be simply to extend the sales tax to services. So what you could do to come up with the money to pay for this, the 10%, is simply put a sales tax on services. That would generate the money to cover the increased costs, and the state would be insuring thousands, tens of thousands more citizens. So it's simply politics would block it. Rationality would say the state is going to do it. It remains to be seen what wins out in the legislature.
Bob Roberts, attorney and professor of public policy from James Madison University. Tim Jost, attorney and professor of health law from Washington and Lee University, are our guests. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. We've got all of our lines open now at 888-WMRA Talk, 888-967-2825. And Tim Jost, I want to get back, and I suspect we may go back several times to this thing about Medicaid, because that's so much up in the air. And there are some specifics that I'm sure you'll want to get into in terms of how long the federal government pays 100% of the cost of the increase, and then when the state might have to begin to pay some portion of adding additional people to the Medicaid rolls. But we have several questions that have already come in, Tim, on our Facebook posting, and it looks like several of these are for you. So here's one from Mike, who says, if I only work 8 months of the year and only have health insurance during those months, would I still have to pay a penalty for not having insurance the rest of the year? And this is something that he's talking about when the law goes into full effect in 2014?
Yes. Well, it would depend on my circumstances. In the first place, the individual responsibility provision only applies after a person has been uninsured for 3 months or more. So if you work 9 months a year, you would automatically not be covered. Beyond that, the question is health insurance affordable to you? And affordability is defined in terms of being able to find a basic high deductible health insurance policy for 60% or for 8% or less, excuse me, for 8% or less of your income. And so if you're in a situation where you're eligible for Medicaid, if you're in a situation where you can get a premium tax credit from the government that will reduce your cost to less than 8% of your income, if your employer will cover you and you only have to pay less than 8% of your income for the premium, then you do have an obligation to get insured. If you don't have any of those things and you're just out there buying insurance on your own, the average family health insurance policy that qualifies is probably going to cost between $12,000 and $12,500. So if Mike is earning less than $150,000 a year and has a family, he wouldn't have to purchase health insurance or pay the penalty. The penalty only applies again if you can afford health insurance and you don't buy it.
You're nodding your head, Bob.
Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma because the way this works between employers now and the exchanges, and the exchanges theoretically will go into effect in 2014, is that employers have to offer you a plan that is affordable. And that's the key part of the plan has to be affordable. If it's too expensive, if the employer is offering you a plan that's too expensive, you can then go to the exchange, and that money follows you from the employer to the exchange. So in theory, the employer may have to pay money into the exchange to cover you through that exchange.
Tim, just explain for us what Bob means when he's talking about the exchange.
Well, the exchange is a marketplace that every state should establish. In states that don't establish it, the federal government will establish it. But it's basically...
These are healthcare exchanges.
It's a healthcare insurance marketplace. And so it's sort of like a farmer's market. It's a place where you will go. Most people will go there as a website, and it will show you, you know, these are the 25 plans that are available to you. And you'll be able to compare them apples to apples. There will be the same form, just like a nutrition label that is now used on cans, so food cans, so that you can just compare one plan to the next and decide which is best for you. And then if you're qualified for a subsidy, for a premium tax credit, then you can use that money to help purchase the plan, and then you'll have to pay some of your own money as well. But it's basically a simplified way of shopping for health insurance in the individual market.
But the system does encourage employers to provide health insurance.
That's correct. It doesn't quite operate the way you described it. It did operate that way, but that was changed in an amendment last year.
Okay.
That was Ron Wyden's idea. The way it works, though, is that if your employer does not offer you affordable health insurance coverage and you do go to the exchange and get a federal tax subsidy to pay for your health insurance, then your employer has to pay a penalty if it's a large employer.
Right.
Small employers don't.
Under 50.
Yeah.
Under 50 employees.
Under 50 employees.
So back to our Virginia Inside Facebook page. This from Jennifer. Mike, by the way, thank you for your question. Jennifer says, when the health law goes into full effect and all those millions more people have coverage, are people going to be able to get in to see a doctor? Are our emergency rooms going to be even more overcrowded? Tim?
Well, logic would suggest that emergency rooms will be less overcrowded because right now, if you are uninsured, that is the one place you can go for care and be sure that you'll get it. And in fact, Americans use emergency rooms for care more than just about anybody else in the world, except for possibly Canadians. In most countries, they have systems worked out so you don't have to go to an emergency room if you don't happen to get sick during working hours. But emergency rooms will probably be less overcrowded. There will be a real demand placed on our healthcare system because people who are not getting medical care right now will be getting it. Now, there are a number of provisions in the bill that are there to help cover this. One is that the bill has provided $72.5 million in Virginia for community health centers, such as the one we have in Harrisonburg. Mm-hmm. So there are provisions in the bill to try to beef up the workforce and make more care available. Right now, a sixth of the population can't get access to health care with their health insurance. And when those people get into the market, the rest of us may have to wait a little bit longer.
And there's a dilemma here because Obama was asked this exact question about 2 weeks ago at one of his town hall type events. And he was asked, you know, what are we to do since we don't have enough general practitioners?
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of people going through medical school don't want to become general practitioners. They're becoming specialists. We haven't really dealt with that issue, that somehow for this system to work in the long term, either we're going to have to get a way to have an incentive for general practitioners or rely, as he said, Obama said, much more on nurse practitioners and physician assistants, much more than we have in the past.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
Something has to be done to increase it. And probably nurse practitioners, physician assistants can add a lot to solving that problem.
Do you have questions about what happens next in healthcare, either across the country or here in Virginia? Got opinions about what you think should happen? Our conversation with public policy expert Bob Roberts and health law expert Tim Jost continues in just a bit. Bob Roberts. has authored numerous books about public policy and American politics. One of his most recent is titled Ethics in U.S. Government, an Encyclopedia of Investigations, Scandals, and Reforms. Timothy Jost is co-author of Health Law, one of the most frequently used textbooks on that subject. His most recent book for lay audiences is titled Health Care at Risk. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Call-in phone lines are starting to light up, but we've still got one line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Do you want to make that personal revelation, Tim, that you can I summarize it without getting too personal? I mean, it relates to a question that we got from a listener
earlier. I was just talking about my own personal medical situation, and without going into too much detail about the specialist, I've been waiting for about 2 weeks now to get in with a specialist. So it's not like we have instant access to medical care at this point in the United States.
But that is likely to get worse when all of a sudden you've got millions of more people entering the system.
I think that's hard to say. We have a very serious maldistribution of medical skill in this country. And there are things in the legislation. There's a lot of stuff in the legislation that is aimed at increasing the workforce, but also reorienting the use of the workforce. And that's something that's happening anyway. I mean, we need to use physicians where their skills are really needed and use people who are well-trained to deal with other kinds of problems where you don't need somebody who's been through years and years at medical school and residency.
888-WMRA-TALK, our phone number. Patrick in Harrisonburg, thanks for dialing in on that number. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Sure. On the air, my comment, first of all, is on an ethical level, it just makes sense to me that no one should have to pay for healthcare in this country. That's where I'm coming from, and it's often frustrating in the debate that that's not brought up. But
Patrick, tell me what you mean by no one paying. You don't mean doctors working for free, do you?
No, not at all. I guess what I mean is the burden to pay should be shouldered by us collectively rather than as an individual. And so the system that I've heard sort of maybe most realistic to respond to that would be, a single system or an expansion of Medicare. Like I heard it proposed that the age limit for Medicare be sort of decreased by a decade each decade, and then private insurance kind of phased out so that, 10 years from now, it would go down to, I don't know the details, but like 50, and then 10 years after that, 40, and then slowly until everyone was covered by government insurance in that way. But
so, Patrick, what you're after is a single payer system.
Yeah, and
Bob Roberts, that was discussed
absolutely
in the heated debate up to what eventually became law. I sometimes find it somewhat ironic that people who deride the Health Care Reform Act call it Obamacare because it really wasn't the president's preference what ended up getting passed.
Correct. And the dilemma with a single payer system is you have to impose a rather substantial tax across the board to pay for it. In other words, and what it does is it removes a risk-based assessment system, whereby right now for the vast majority of people, unless you're in group plans, your health insurance premiums are dependent somewhat upon risk factors. A single payer system spreads that risk to everybody in society, and therefore everybody in society has to pay into a pool to pay for it. A lot of Americans don't like that on the belief that they shouldn't have to pay for the health care of somebody else, and that's why the single payer system hasn't succeeded here. It would be a lot simpler. Administratively, it would be a lot more efficient. But for whatever reason, lots of Americans don't like that idea because they don't want to be paying for someone else's health care. They feel that they should be paying for their own health care. And that has created this dilemma that we find ourselves in now.
Patrick, thanks so much for your call. Tim Jost, and all the study that you've done about healthcare systems in different places throughout the industrialized world. Is a single payer one of the most popular in other countries, or is it more of a hybrid?
Well, virtually every developed country other than the United States has universal health coverage.
And there are several ways of getting there. A single-payer system in the sense of a system where everything is tax-financed is one approach. Another approach that's very common is what's called a social insurance system, where you basically have nonprofit insurers that are funded through payroll taxes often, sort of like our Medicare Part A. And then there are a couple of countries, the Netherlands and Switzerland, that have a system similar to what we're going to have under the Affordable Care Act, where everyone is required to purchase insurance from a private insurer. None of them are perfect, but we do have far and away the most expensive system in the world. All of the other countries, and countries really that are very wealthy countries, have and that have very good quality health care, have been able to do it much less expensively than we do. And Bob's absolutely right that we didn't go the direction of a single-payer system because of politics. But when you look at what is involved in making a private health insurance system work, it is incredibly complicated and incredibly inefficient.
Right.
But that was the only political alternative we had to get to near universal coverage.
And some of those other countries who have universal coverage got it many years ago before a for-profit model of insurance companies became a major part of their societies?
That's true. And although in most countries of the world, private insurance continues to exist, of course, in all other fields, but even private health insurance, a very high percentage of Canadians have private health insurance. But to cover things like drugs and dental and vision and things like that, rather than really basic medical care.
Roy in Harrisonburg, we were just about to take your call and the line was dropped. I don't know if you had to hang up or if we lost your call by accident. If you want to call back, we'd be happy to hear your question or comment at 888-WMRA. Talk 888-967-2825. We have this on one of our Facebook pages from someone named Normal. I saw his picture, so I know it is a male person. And he says, what should be done about healthcare next? Get the community together and design your own. That's what every state should do while waiting for federally run Obamacare to be repealed. Unfortunately, Normal says, I live in Democratic Illinois. Interesting, he's listening from there. And then he has a sort of opposite of a smiley face. I guess it's a sad emoticon. It strikes me, Bob Roberts, that Normal is talking about exactly what you were, that the politics in the U.S. is such that there are many people who oppose any kind of universal coverage.
It's amazing that most Americans don't understand right now that their insurance is state regulated. That all 50 states regulate the insurance policies that can be sold in their states and, in fact, set what the requirements of those plans are. So we've got 50 different systems, which are terribly inefficient. No. I mean, it's just terribly inefficient to have 50 state regulators of insurance systems and legislators intervening year after year, deciding what has to be covered, what isn't covered. That's exactly what he wants, and that's probably the most inefficient system you can have.
The other thing is we've really had private health insurance in the United States since about 1940.
Right.
And in that whole time, health insurance has been subject to state regulation. And a number of states have tried repeatedly to come up with solutions to extending health insurance, to making health care more affordable, et cetera. Those experiments have not been terribly successful.
And has Massachusetts worked?
Well, Massachusetts is probably the most successful experiment we've had to date. But Massachusetts received significant its governor at that time was successful in obtaining very significant federal subsidies to make its system work. And without federal money in the system, and without coordinating Medicaid with the rest of the system, it's really difficult to make it work. And also, if anyone can leave a state if they feel that the system there is getting too expensive for them, and that makes it very difficult for states to really fund health insurance systems that really work.
Washington and Lee University law professor and specialist in health policy, Tim Jost is one of our guests. Sitting next to him, James Madison University Professor of Political Science and Public Administration, Bob Roberts. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, talking about what next in healthcare, both across the country and here in Virginia. Your comments and questions welcome at 888-WMRA-TALK. Next to Ruth in Harrisonburg. Ruth, thanks for dialing in. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, I had a comment and then a question, I guess. My comment would be that what I expect to see based on the passage of this legislation, having practiced law in Harrisonburg in the past, I know the first bankruptcy case I had was a family who came in just overwhelmed with humiliation and disgrace that they had to go into bankruptcy, and it was because they had a stack of doctor bills, they had illnesses. And so I'll never forget that experience. To me, the idea that millions of people who go into bankruptcy now solely because of medical debt, that relief for people is important. I think we don't discuss the moral issues very much here, and to me, there are enormous moral issues in the imposition on people of the medical debts like this that they can't help incurring to just kind of wreck their life and derail them the way it does. And the other thing I saw was people being locked into a job because it has health care when there may be a better job, but that one doesn't have health coverage and they have health situations they can't risk making the switch. So it interferes with people, you know, working their way up and getting the best job they can for their talents and abilities when we have this uneven system of some people being covered and others not. But I guess, so, and again, the fact that we have 50 million people without care, I have a question about the fact that the coverage now under the new legislation, I think, will add maybe 30 million. What happens to that other number between the 30 million and the 50 million that we hear who do not have coverage? Are they covered under Medicaid expansions if their state does it, or are there a certain number of people who will be able to afford care but will prefer not to get it?
Well, let me answer that question. In the first place, a large number of those will be undocumented aliens, and there is no provision for them in this legislation. That was too politically dangerous, and so there's no provision for them in this legislation other than that they will continue to go to emergency rooms when they really need care. But about a third of the people who will remain uncovered will be people who are eligible for Medicaid, but who for whatever reason don't get around to signing up or can't figure out how to sign up. Those people will be covered if they end up in a hospital. Hospitals will be able to make presumptive eligibility determinations, and so they will, in a sense, have a form of catastrophic coverage because if anything terribly wrong goes wrong with them, they will be able to get on Medicaid rather than having to go bankrupt. And then there will be some people left who will not be able to afford health insurance but will not be eligible for the subsidies. And those people, again, are not subject to the penalty, but they will not have an immediate route to coverage under this legislation.
Ruth, thank you so much for your call. Some pundits have been saying that if the Supreme Court had thrown out the Obama administration's health care law, that would have energized Democrats, making it more likely that the president would be reelected this fall and that his party might even retake the House. But now that most of the Affordable Care Act has been upheld, this could have the effect, this theory goes, of energizing Tea Party conservatives, giving Mitt Romney a boost and making it more likely the Republicans could win back control of the Senate. What do you think? Will health care make any difference at all in how you vote this November? We'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Bob Roberts, how do you see the politics of this plan?
Right now it's working out very strangely because everybody expected that Romney and the Republicans would jump and attack, make this a number one. They haven't. They've made the tax the issue that Obama promised not to raise taxes. They haven't gone out and attacked the substantive parts of the bill that much. Why? Because There are a number of provisions that are very popular in the bill. Health insurance up to 26, no pre-existing conditions, free wellness checks. All those things have been accepted by the American people as very, very helpful. They like them. But what they don't like, and this is, I sincerely believe there's a group of Americans who really misunderstand what this has done, and particularly Medicare recipients, who somehow believe, and because Obama didn't do a very good job explaining this, that somehow this healthcare expansion is being funded on the backs of Medicare recipients. And that group is not very happy. And therefore, overall, I don't think the electorate is very unhappy with it. But there may be pockets within the electorate very unhappy. And those pockets vote. That one pocket of senior citizens are a very, very powerful voting bloc. And so I don't think it's as simple as it may seem in terms of who's for it and who's against it.
Another thing I've seen in the last couple of days in polling is that a lot of Americans are ready to move on, that people are getting tired of the constant bickering about health care and are more interested in other things. And so I think that probably this is a red meat issue for the base on both parties. And if what you're really interested in is getting people out there manning the phones and knocking on doors, it might be a good issue. But I think
a lot
of independents...
But in a race that appears as if it's going to be as close, at least as current polling, who knows what's going to happen 4 months from now, but current polling shows, isn't energizing the base a major factor?
I think it is. No. On the other hand, alienating independents isn't a good idea either. So I think that's the calculus.
And I think that there is a calculus that Americans are beginning to understand what the bill does. And they're not that unhappy with what the bill does.
Well, that's interesting, Bob Roberts, because I keep hearing news reports where people talk about an overwhelming majority of Americans being, in recent surveys, being against this Affordable Care Act that, again, deridingly is often referred to as Obamacare.
But if you ask them specific questions, do they believe 26-year-olds should be covered? They'll say yes.
But, Tim Jost, is it also true that when you talk to people in those surveys about whether or not they favor this, something like 20 to 25% say they don't favor it because they wanted something more along the lines of what Patrick was talking about?
Yeah, well,
they wanted it to go further.
That's a really important point, because if you ask people, do you like this bill or do you not like it, you do get not overwhelming majorities, but you do get majorities opposed, or at least close to 50% opposed and smaller in favor. But then when you ask them, did it go too far, did it not go far enough, a significant percentage, I saw a figure recently that 65% believe that the legislation either did the right thing or didn't go far enough, as opposed to about 30% who were opposed to it because they felt that it went too far, or they didn't want it at all.
This is one of those rare occasions where you're going to get a chance to think about the question, because we're just about to hit the break, but I want to make sure that Sue knows that we did see her question posted on our Virginia Insight Facebook page, which says, how many people in Virginia do not now have health insurance? If Virginia does sign on for increased Medicaid coverage under Obamacare, how many more Virginians would then be covered? So we'll let you think about that. I don't know if you know the answers to that, but we'll find out. Carol from Lexington, we've also got you on the line, and we're going to take your call very quickly after we get back from this brief break. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Tim Jost, attorney and professor of health law, one of our guests. Bob Roberts, attorney and professor of politics and public policy, the other. Who wants to take a shot at Sue's questions about numbers of uninsured in Virginia?
Yeah, there are about 1 million uninsured in Virginia, 1,200,000 uninsured in Virginia. 1,002,000 uninsured in Virginia. Of those, 462,000 would be covered by the Medicaid expansions, which would be about 46%. I don't have the exact number on the numbers who would receive premium tax credits, but I would guess it would be another 200,000 to 300,000. So most Virginians who are uninsured would be covered under the Affordable Care Act.
It sounds, Bob Roberts, like Virginia is in better shape than the national average based on our population compared to the number of people who are not insured.
It sounds like it. I mean, it sounds like that's, but I'm not sure the national numbers in terms of, I would expect Virginia because it has a little, it's one of the wealthier states in the country, and therefore it has a higher per capita income that we would have fewer individuals without insurance.
888-WMRA Talk, our number. Carol in Lexington, thanks for using it. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, I am wondering why there is no consideration about incentivizing individuals to adopt healthier lifestyles by offering those people lower premiums. I'm just looking at the larger picture of increasing health care costs and wondering how that can be possibly stalled or slowed down.
Right now, we currently, if you buy a private health insurance plan, you are risk assessed. I mean, you have a medical exam. They will charge you if they're going to write insurance for you. They do for high blood pressure, other things, they'll charge you more. So what you're saying under the group plans, for example, if someone keeps their blood pressure down, they have low cholesterol, that the system would rebate them money for healthier lifestyles?
Yes.
That is permitted under the Affordable Care Act, and in fact, it's encouraged. I teach at Washington and Lee, and we do have a wellness program, and our premiums are reduced if we do a bunch of things that are supposed to increase our wellness. There is provision for that for group plans in the Affordable Care Act. There's also provision for a demonstration project for individual plans. Wellness programs are a good idea. They do get people more conscious of their health. They get people more involved in activities such as smoking cessation or weight reduction. There is some concern about wellness programs, however, among a lot of the consumer advocacy groups that I work with. I work with quite a number of groups like the American Cancer Society or the American Heart Association. And the problem is, to the extent that wellness programs like ours at Washington and Lee take into account biometric measures, they can have the effect of penalizing people for things like cholesterol level or blood pressure levels that they can't necessarily do much about. A lot of that is genetic. You can change it to some extent, but you can't change it immediately. So I think wellness programs are a good idea. They are part of the Affordable Care Act. They are encouraged by the Affordable Care Act. But they're something that make me a little nervous because part of the purpose of the Affordable Care Act was to get rid of risk underwriting, to say that we aren't going to punish people for being sick.
Carol, I suspect that you may be talking about giving lower rates to people who don't smoke or who don't drink.
About obesity. I'm thinking about what is the incentive for people out there to be taking a look. I mean, when you see so many younger people and the obesity epidemic, what's going to incentivize them to not be costing everyone else out there who is trying to keep their weight down, trying to exercise, trying to eat properly? Those people end up paying for those who are saying, well, it doesn't matter. I'm 100 pounds overweight. I've got this health plan.
Well, there's a fair amount of research that shows that simply giving a person a little discount on their premium doesn't have that much of an effect on obesity. It does on some other things, but obesity, you're right, is one of the biggest cost factors in our healthcare system going forward. But if you know people who are struggling with weight gain, it's not, I don't know of anyone who would say, I'm not going to worry about it because I have an insurance policy. There are so many reasons in this society to lose weight. And for a lot of people, it's very difficult, particularly given all of the incentives we have in our society to eat too much. And there's a lot of those out there, and a lot of those are subsidized by the federal and state government. So it's a good idea, and it's there in the Affordable Care Act, but I don't think it's a panacea. To give people a $25 deduction on their insurance premium.
Carol, thanks so much for your call. To you on the other side of your radio, should Virginia expand Medicaid coverage to more poor people in our Commonwealth? The the question we talked about near the beginning of the hour. We'd like to get your opinion on this. Now, this would mean taking federal dollars to do so for the complete cost of that expansion for the first few years. But eventually, it would mean that state taxes might have to go up as those federal dollars were reduced. So are you willing to pay more so that more Virginians have health care? We've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can reach us through our Facebook page where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. So, Tim Jost, remind us of the specifics on this. 2014, when the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented, is when states will be offered what to do what.
Okay, in 2014, with respect to the Medicaid expansion, for the first 3 years, 14, 15, and 16, the federal government finances 100% of it, of the expansion costs of covering the additional people.
You cover people
up to 138% of poverty level. And
in right now, many states don't even cover everybody in.
Well, in Virginia, you can't get Medicaid if you're not aged, disabled, blind, a child, or the parents of a child.
Right.
So if you're,
so the misperception that many people have is that Medicaid automatically covers everybody below the poverty level.
Absolutely.
No,
that's
not
the case.
Absolutely not. The other thing, and then after 2016, it gradually phases in so that by 2020, the state would be paying 10%. It's not at all clear, however, that that will require a raise in taxes because we're already paying for many of those people in various ways through because they're getting their care now. I mean, they're getting a lot less. They're getting it when it's less effective. They're probably getting it often when it's more expensive. But we're already paying for it. This is just a way of paying for it that is more efficient, I believe.
And it's more efficient for this reason, too, because right now insurance companies, hospitals particularly, factor into their fee structure unreimbursed care. So in a sense, they'll charge insured patients more. Now, if they're being reimbursed by Medicaid, there's a possibility that health insurance costs for people who are covered by other plans won't go up as quickly.
And there's also a political factor here, Bob Roberts. If our current governor, Bob McDonnell, does not become vice president next year or get named to a Romney cabinet, in other words, if he stays in office in Virginia as governor for the last year of his term, you think he has some incentive politically to want to go along with the Obama administration on expanding Medicaid?
Knowing Virginia politics, there will be tremendous pressure from major economic forces in this state for him to go along. Healthcare is one of the largest industries in the state of Virginia and employs a huge number of people. This money will help those institutions. And therefore, if he opposes it, there will be a political cost to pay. Maybe not from the members of the House of Delegates, but from those who support politicians. In other words, for those who want to create jobs, for those who want the health industry to expand, those groups want this money.
Some of Bob McDonnell's friends in politics, some of his contributors are in the healthcare industry?
Correct.
And also, it's important to remember that if Virginia doesn't do the expansion, Pennsylvania or New York or California or some other states will, and Virginia tax dollars will be heading into the federal government to pay for expansions in other states and jobs and healthcare in other states. So it's the effect of the Supreme Court decision is that you don't have to take the money if you don't want it, but you still have to pay it.
And there's another factor.
We're going to run out of time, and Fred has been very patiently waiting on the phone line. So let's get his perspective.
All right.
Fred in Elkton, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for public policy specialist Bob Roberts or healthcare law specialist Tim Jost, please.
I'm a graduate student at the University of Virginia, and I'm married and I have two kids. And, my wife can't work because I go to school. And we're in this zone, as a stipend, I don't make very much at all.
Right.
But I make too much for us to get Medicaid for her.
Right.
And you know, if they expand it, we're just going to be covered, and it'll be great. But, you know, right now we're week to week,
right?
You know, meeting the, everything, and, you know, if anybody gets sick, I mean, it's a constant worry.
Right.
And so it's just a very frustrating thing, and I want to know what the take is on that. Like, and also, how does someone with healthcare in general being such an expense, how does anyone make that leap from, you know, a lower class to the middle class or higher? Like, how could one account for that? How could anyone think this is a bad thing?
Well, you are in the group that would be covered through the premium tax credits. And so what would happen essentially is that you would go in and apply. They would look at your income. You would have to pay a certain percentage of your income, maybe 6%, 4% for health insurance, and then the government would cover up everything on top of that. And so you would be able to get health insurance, and it would be affordable, but it wouldn't be free. And so, but getting from here to there, in Virginia, there isn't very much to help you. In some states, they already have programs to help that population, but we don't have anything in Virginia.
And we forget this, that we have a lot of employers in this state who have under 50. A lot of jobs are created by smaller employers. With this Medicaid expansion, you'll have a lot more employees who are working who will be covered by health insurance and will not have to be covered by, theoretically, their employers. That's going to create opportunities for more employment. People are saying it's going to lose jobs because bigger employers, but a lot of employers right now can't afford health insurance for their employees in the private sector, and therefore this will give a greater incentive for employers to hire people who have health insurance. They're going to be more productive. They're not going to be sick as much. It's going to help the economy.
Fred, we do wish you the very best of luck. Hopefully you'll get better soon in terms of when the federal health care law goes into effect in a little bit less than 18 months. Quick question for you. What are you graduate studenting in?
I study ecology.
I'm sorry?
I study ecology. And
you study
science.
Ecology. Well, thank you for doing that. Thank you for calling in. The best of luck to you.
This conversation. It's much appreciated.
We have a quick question here from Bethany, who apparently missed our discussion at the beginning of the hour, wants to know about how the new health care law might affect free clinics in Virginia. Can you remind us, Tim Jost?
Well, free clinics are still going to be around, and free clinics are going to have a very important niche, which is that, again, as I said, undocumented workers will not be able to get health care through the Medicaid or through the premium tax credits. And so it's very important that free clinics be around for people who don't have access to care in any other way. But I think they will also continue to be important for the population that, for whatever reason, doesn't get help under the Affordable Care Act other than undocumented workers. For example, again, people who cannot afford health insurance, whose income is too high for the premium tax credits, and who but still who can't afford health insurance aren't subject to the penalty. Those people will probably still be uninsured, and they may turn to free clinics. So I think there will continue to be lots of opportunities for medical personnel who want to donate their services to find people who need them.
Reminds me that Roy, whose call we lost earlier, I did get a note about part of his question being, will doctors under this Federal Reform Act be forced to see more patients?
No. Nope. They'll be given.
That's the first simple, straightforward. I mean, completely not that the rest of it wasn't straightforward, but they just caught me by surprise.
They will be paid to see more patients, and I guess financial incentives are a form of compulsion, but no. I mean, any doctor who doesn't want to be a doctor or doesn't want to serve patients won't have to.
Which creates a problem.
Yeah.
Because in a sense, you are seeing more and more doctors not seeing Medicaid patients. You're seeing some doctors now not seeing Medicare patients and believe they can still have a very successful practice by not doing so.
And, Bob Roberts, my beginning question to you, and there's been lots of good information from both you and Tim. Thank you both for that. We're almost out of time, so let me go back to this, was how this is going to play out politically in Virginia. And you said as far as Medicaid, it could go either way. There are issues on both sides. In terms of the fall election, Will this make any difference in whether Virginia goes in the blue column or the red column for president this year?
I don't think so. I think the health care issue is not going to be a huge issue in the fall campaign. It's the overall economy that's going to be the issue. And that you're seeing that now reflected that neither campaign is really making it a big issue because their polling is showing that it's really not at the top of the agenda for most voters.
And Tim Jost, one last quick question for you. In terms of the fact that you mentioned earlier the U.S. pays much more than all the other industrialized countries for its healthcare system, how much more and why?
Oh, probably about twice as much as the average per capita expenditure for other countries. And in large part because we just don't have any way of controlling healthcare costs. We pay in so many different ways through so many different kinds of insurance companies.
Do you think this new law, when it's fully implemented, is going to change that?
I think it has a lot of good ideas in it to control costs. It's not a panacea.
Our guests have been Tim Jost, professor of health law at Washington and Lee University and author of the book Healthcare at Risk, as well as Bob Roberts, author of Ethics in U.S. Government and professor of politics and public policy at James Madison University. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.